The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
At last, we're in the final days of the Georgia governor's race, or are we? The contest between Democrat Stacey Abrams and Republican Brian Kemp could come down to whether Libertarian Ted Metz forces a runoff, or it could even end up in a fight over which ballots get counted and when. But there is a lot more to this election, and we got into it on an evening diner edition of The Political Breakfast. It's a pleasure to have your company. I'm Dennis O'Hare. For this edition, we had a lot of guests at the table, a live audience at Emory Law School the night of November 1st, and they heard from our regulars, Brian Robinson, a Republican strategist and former deputy chief of staff for Governor Nathan Deal, and Theron Johnson, a Democratic strategist and former National Southern Regional Director of the Obama 2012 campaign. By the way, Theron and Brian will join us the morning after the election at 9:30 on 90.1 WABE for a special broadcast to pick through the results and try to make sense of them. But right now, it's off to Emory Law.
All right, let's start. We, as we speak, are just days away from a hotly contested gubernatorial race, which has really dominated all of the other races on the ticket. But we got to start with this governor's race, which has gained attention around the country. Theron and Brian both have been in campaigns, and that's what's so important about this, because they can tell you what campaigns are thinking right now. A lot of us are focused on the possibility of a runoff, because the race is on the razor's edge, and Libertarian Ted Metz is pulling enough to perhaps force a runoff, because neither candidate will get 50%. Theron, I'll start with you. Are the campaigns, though, thinking not even so much about a runoff, but what they might do if there is someone who gets a majority and they call in the lawyers?
Well, that's the exact question that a lot of people who are looking at this race are wondering what the campaigns are thinking. I think if you're in the Abrams campaign right now, number one, she's got to be very, very happy of the position that she's in right now. This is a state that has traditionally been Republican. She is polling basically ahead of some polls and barely behind in some polls against a Republican that many would have thought around this time would have actually kind of pulled away. So number one is that she's telling her people right now that we can win this without a runoff. She's telling her staffers and she's telling every donor and every voter who will listen that if you go out and vote early, or if you go out and vote on election day, we can win this race without a runoff. And I think that's got to be the consistent message going forward. Now, the one thing that I'm sure her campaign manager is looking at is that when we have record-breaking numbers of early voters and absentee, and we roughly have about over 500,000 voters who did not vote at all in 2014, they have such a very scientific, analytical process within the campaign to know who these voters are. So the bottom line is this, Dennis, is that I think that Abrams' pathway to victory looks like this. It's continuing to get the amount of African-American votes, which I think she'll get 90% of them, and then she's got to get upwards to 25% to somewhere between 30% of the white voters. And the other thing that she has spent an enormous amount of time on, and organizations have as well, is registering new voters. voters, hopefully, that were not purged or that are not letting this sort of exact match law sort of deter them from going to the polls. But the bottom line is this, to your last point, is no matter what happens, if she were to win and barely win, you better believe that there's a lot of law firms in this state and out of state that are preparing right now for lawsuits. Because the bottom line is that the narrative has sort of been laid out by a lot of the political rhetoric that we hear from both sides in this race.
Yeah, the idea of voter suppression or absentee ballots that may or may not be counted, and there's a legal fight going on over that as we speak. Brian, obviously the Republicans, are they also thinking about, we got to call in the lawyers if we have to, and instead of a runoff, we might be looking at a court battle?
There's not going to be a runoff. Brian Kemp's going to win by 3 or 4 points, probably. I think he'll get right around. I love the hissing. We don't get that in the studio.
This is except
from the
baby.
Old air conditioner. That is
untapped.
He's going to get around 51%, which is about what Trump got. And look, I did deal 2010, deal 2014, and in both of them, we went into those final weekends with Atlanta media going, headed toward a runoff. And they were so excited because, of course, you know, Atlanta media is another word for, you know, Atlanta Democrats. And so they were like, so thank God we're finally going to win this one. And there's so much hope and expectation. And Dill won by 10 points in 2010. He won by 7 points in 2014, as did David Perdue. That, you know, they said he and Michelle Nunn are going to a runoff as well. And it's just never there. For whatever reason, Democrats get oversampled in Georgia polling. Now, I'm not blaming pollsters for that. It's really hard to figure out who is voting here. There's a lot of
especially if you have new voters.
Yeah, we have 900,000 new voters since 2014. So if there's been a voter suppression campaign, it's the worst one ever, right? It has failed miserably because we have registered almost 1 million people in 4 years. So Brian Kemp should get some credit, and there's been a national media effort to give him cover to attack him on this. But no Secretary of State has registered more voters in Georgia history than he has. He's created apps. You can do it online. There's a ton of ways to do it.
The counter-argument has been he's also purged a whole bunch of folks.
He has. Implemented state law, which was passed by the General Assembly and signed by Governor Deal and upheld by the courts. So this whole thing that he's acting, you know, on his own, okay, he's a renegade doing all this crazy stuff extrajudicially, is false. He is enforcing what the Georgia law is.
So here's the problem with that, and Brian is... We get paid to spend. But the one thing that he left out is, like, it's really interesting to me is that when something bad happens, the Secretary of State's office, they blame it on county officials. But when something good happens, like, ooh, we got all these newly registered voters, Brian Kemp takes credit for it. So in 2018, it's not that hard to want to go out after many Democrats woke up in 2016 and said, oh my God, we just elected that guy. And so I think that while, yes, Brian Kemp, to be a fair critic, did sort of bring a 21st century strategy to allow those of us who use technology pretty much for everything now to make it easier. But I do think that what Stacey Abrams has pointed out is that when you look at voter suppression that is going on, if you just look at every single law that has been introduced by Republicans all across this country, it is just baffling to me that we don't recognize that all of these new voter restriction laws disproportionately affect people of color. And so one of the things that I think that's happened is that the Abrams campaign had to get back on message as far as talking about the issue, because this race became very black and white. It became that you had this white Secretary of State who was purging 1.4 million voters off the list since 2012, and now he's telling people who are on this exact match list that they can't vote. Well, Brian Kemp was very quick to come out and say that these folks could vote on a provisional ballot. But one of the things that I think is that you cannot poll, Dennis, back to your original point about being inside a campaign. When you're inside of a campaign and you're polling voters, you can't poll enthusiasm, and you can't poll what we like to call low propensity, infrequent and sporadic voters. These are voters that came out for Donald Trump in 2016 that Republicans had not seen on the voting rolls for a long time. These are voters who probably voted for President Obama in 2008 and in 2012, and they didn't turn out at all in probably 2014 or 16. And so I think ultimately what's going to happen on Election Day is that the Abrams campaign got to basically make sure that all of this resource, these resources and this money that she's had and this time that she's spent going across the state bringing these new voters to the fold, they've got to turn out and vote.
How?
It's the thing is that Theron's always talking about these, that Georgia is a demographically a blue state, electorally a red state. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. But Stacey Abrams and Theron have kept going back to, you know, there are all these minority voters who aren't voting. And who is this mythical black voter who didn't vote for Obama?
Well, it's,
I mean, if they didn't vote for Obama, they're not going to vote. I mean, you have to use Brian Kemp's term, throw them in the back of the truck and take them to the polls. That's the reference to the commercial. You know, you have to force them to go vote. If they didn't go vote for Obama, they're not going to.
Well, I think and we'll move on, Dennis. To be fair, I think that one of the things that the Abrams campaign has actually reminded us is that even in 2016, and I was on the 2012 President Barack Obama reelection campaign, I think in 2012, Brian, we had roughly about 500,000 African Americans who didn't go out. In 2016, there was roughly 600,000+ African Americans who were registered that didn't turn out. So they're not phantom. They're there, believe it or not. But the bottom line is that I think that a lot of them have become very apathetic. A lot of them don't really believe in government. And now I think with Abrams being in the lead in some polls and actually showing that her viability is real, I think that may have a tremendous amount of influence for these new voters to come on and vote.
Let me pick up on a thread that was kind of running under this, because both of you referred to it, the notion of race. We have seen next door in Florida, certainly race has been an undercurrent in some of the issues that we've talked about in Georgia, like whether there is or isn't voter suppression. But in Florida, it amped up into the races of the two candidates for governor. You know, of course, DeSantis with that famous monkey it up remark. That hasn't happened here. And how conscious, and Brian, I'll start with you, how conscious would the Kemp campaign have to be of that? And do they run the risk, though, of sending out something that might be construed as a dog whistle to racist voters?
I give them credit. They are very aware of that, and they're very sensitive, and they walk on eggshells about it. I sent them over something earlier in the fall, and it was kind of during the Colin Kaepernick stuff resurfacing with Nike, and some Republicans in other states had used that as a meme of some sort. And I sent it to them, like, hey, this is funny, you might like it. And they were like, we'll get called racist. You know, so it was like they wouldn't even consider the idea because they were very sensitive to that context. And I give them credit for that. So they haven't. Look, the New York Times and the Washington Post have never given two rips about Georgia politics. And all of a sudden, it's the center of the universe. And they're writing about it constantly. Stacey Abrams may be Jesus' sister was a headline in the New York Times. All of a sudden, they're all about this race. And I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's okay. I mean, parenthetically, I mean, the last time that I remember the New York Times so interested in a Georgia race was when Roy Barnes lost, and it was Roy Barnes who said he knew he was in trouble any time he saw himself mentioned in the New York Times.
Yeah, well, now, you know, they're very interested, you know, in this race right now, and so they're covering every angle of it.
But we haven't seen the DeSantis-Gillum thing here.
No, I kind of...
I'm sorry. Train of thought back. Let me finish. Okay. Sorry.
You got to give me back some time.
Yeah, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and CNN, all of them, they're laying in wait for Brian Kemp to say something racist to blow it up. And I think they're aware of that. And so they're very cautious. I saw him doing an interview, this weekend, and he was asked about the role of race in the state, and I think there's a tendency amongst some candidates to sort of play the role of pundit, and I give him credit for not. He goes, "That's not what this is about. This is about the direction of the state. I have nothing but tremendous respect for my opponent."
Yeah, I slightly disagree because I think that in 2018, we have implicit bias. We have the dog whistle talk. And let me just be more specific.
Yeah, you got an example of that.
No, I'll give you a lot of examples. Okay. So when you guys turn on your television screens, it's just code words now. You know, Stacey Abrams is too extreme for Georgia. Like, I kind of sound like the voiceover, right? Because I've heard it so much. Well, when you call a black person extreme, it has a different sort of message to white voters than it has to black voters. Let me be more specific. As a black man on radio, on national television, local television, being with Brian, I have to be very careful of what I say, but more importantly, how I say it. Even tonight, if I start to raise my voice or appear to be angry, which Brian is going to attempt to do tonight, then I am then considered extreme. Stacey Abrams is too radical for Georgia. Well, how is being radical when you want to expand Medicaid at a time where Georgia is losing $8 million a day? You just want people to have an alternative access to healthcare, but they call her radical. And then let's just be real, because I think this is why our podcast is so good, is that they find the worst picture they can possibly find of her at the worst angle. And so what Brian Kemp and Republicans are forgetting is that this is the year of the woman. We have more women on the ballot in Georgia than anywhere. Than anywhere except Maine. And so while Dennis, yes, Brian Kemp was not stupid enough to come out the day after his election and use the word monkey up. But I think that he understands that while he is in Georgia, that he's allowed his media buyers to try to paint this woman as radical, as extreme, try to, you know, basically to disparage her record, say that she wants to have undocumented people work with. You listen to her whole entire thing. So you don't have to, in this day and age, in 2018, when we have a president who wakes up every morning to try to figure out how can he insult an American, where you don't have to necessarily be specific in your racism, but let's not act like that it's not implicit and it's not these sort of people out here that are unconsciously incompetent of what you do when you send certain signals through dog whistle by calling her these names.
Let's pivot real quickly then to some issues. And you just mentioned one, Theron, which was healthcare and expansion of Medicaid. There has been, I mean, even Stacey Abrams, who I've done many interviews with her over the years, and she has a detailed plan. But when it comes to talking about, okay, eventually that federal match is going to draw down if Obamacare remains as it had been, unless Congress changes things. And then the question is, okay, as the state has to pick up more of this, what do you do? And neither Stacey Abrams nor Brian Kemp has really, at least as much as I've heard, had a really specific response to that. So are we seeing, as has often happened before, campaigns around shiny objects where the candidates can kind of get away with not looking at the real consequences of the positions they're taking? And this applies to both of them.
Well, I'll go first, and I'll give Brian back some time. But see, that's the really difficult thing about running a campaign right now in 2018. The one thing that the Republicans do very well is that they force you to focus on the wedge personal issues that have nothing to really do with policy. So we all know this. When Brian Kemp came out to talk about his healthcare plan, he literally had 7 words on his website. I'm not joking. I can see your faces. No, he had 7 words under his healthcare tab on his website. Now, since then, to be fair, he's gone and had someone like Brian or one of these great Emory policy professors come back and help him with the healthcare plan.
Yeah, I think he even had a press conference.
I'm sure they're big Republicans, yeah.
But the thing that's sort of challenging, Dennis, is that Brian actually does have a record to run on. Now, you know, we gotta forget about, you know, all of our voter data just being, you know, sort of out there, our social security numbers, date of birth, all this personal information. But when you look at the issues, I just believe that Stacey Abrams just is really ready to go. I mean, she's beyond a political wonk when it comes to her specific intelligent plans about what she wants to do for Georgia.
Yeah, but so, expanding Medicaid specifically has a consequence in what are, to use the buzzword, the out years, farther away from now.
And that's fair. And I think what Brian will tell you when I pass it over to him is that I will actually give some credit to some Republicans. And I'm going to give credit to Republicans by not taking any credit away from Stacey Abrams. If she was here right now, she would tell you that, yes, there is going to be, as we like to hear, consequences. But I go back to the fact that we are losing $8 million a day. And I don't care what you guys say. If you got $8 million that can come to this state to help someone live or to help someone with a pre-existing condition, that works. But Brian will tell you that Republicans about 2 years ago started looking at this whole expansion of Medicaid issue, and they really tried to figure out a way to expand it because they knew that no matter who the Democratic nominee was going to be, this was going to be an issue that was going to be front and center during the campaign.
Yeah, Brian, let me pick up on that, because the Republicans have been in control of both houses of the legislature and the governor's mansion since 2003. And they've said, no, you know, we don't want to expand Medicaid, but we'll come up with something. And they haven't, despite other states, including Indiana, that have negotiated deals with the feds that they call it something else, but it's a modified form of Medicaid expansion.
It's called a waiver, and that's probably the direction that we'll end up going no matter what. You know, I think I was talking with a friend of mine who I work with in the governor's office who is an Emory Law School grad today, and I said, here's what I think is going to happen. If Stacey won and she wants to do this, she's got to get this through a Republican General Assembly. They would love to make a point by stopping it, right? I mean, and so what could happen would be the Republicans in the House go to Governor Abrams, and they go, okay, you got to do something really conservative, X, and you got to come out and say, there's no way I'm going to sign that. I'll veto that unless it's attached to Medicaid expansion. And they go, oh, we really don't want to do that. But if we have to do that to get this other thing passed, and I think that's what you're going to have to do, is cut a deal. It's going to be really hard for a Governor Kemp to do it. And here's why. So one thing that's really interesting is that since Obama left office, you know, the Obamacare term has less steam than it did before. Republicans have sort of moved on from the Obama era. And in Georgia now, if you look at the entire, like a general election population in a poll, 65 to 70% of Georgians favor Medicaid expansion. Now, you would never know that, right, from watching our politics, but it's a significant majority. You know, and Theron and I have done campaigns, and when you have a 70% issue, I mean, you hop on it. Yep. I remember having to make this argument to Governor Deal about medical, the cannabis oil in 2014. You know, he's a 76-year-old man from Georgia, so he had a real, psychological hill to get over because of the word marijuana being in it. And I was like, hey, man, this is an 80% issue. And we sort of got him there. So, but here's the box that Republican legislators are in on Medicaid expansion. 42% of Georgia Republicans, and you got to think Georgia Republicans are really conservative. The Georgia primary electorate, Republican primary electorate, is very conservative. Just as the Georgia Democratic electorate is very liberal today.
Progressive.
Very liberal. And 42% of Georgia Republicans are in favor of Medicaid expansion, which makes sense. Many of them are rural, and their economies are hurting, and the hospitals are closing. Here's the box that Republicans are in. 49% are against it. So what do you do? There's really not a way to wiggle out of it, except for the waiver plan, and you can say, I'm doing what Mike Pence did as governor of Indiana.
But why didn't they do that before? Why haven't they done it till now?
I think it hasn't happened up till now because, most legislators, you know, they're farmers, they are pharmacists, they are small business owners. They're not healthcare policy experts. I mean, you'd be shocked. I mean, Mary Margaret can probably back me up that many legislators don't know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid.
I repeat what Mary Margaret said. She said Brian Kemp didn't.
Yeah. So they're not healthcare policy experts.
That reference was to state Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, who is in the audience, a Decatur Democrat. So there you are.
So what we're going to do is something like Indiana did, something that gives them a messaging point. Look, other Republicans have done this. And you're seeing it on the ballot in Montana and Utah, very Republican states. And so as they adopt it, it's going to make it politically easier. Look, if this stays on the books, this is going to happen here, because you cannot turn down that amount of money for decades. And you're going to see, in my opinion, I'm not doing my job as a Republican on this at all. I apologize. You're going to see dual economies in the country. You're going to have Obamacare states and non-Obamacare states, and their healthcare establishments or infrastructure will reflect it. We can't be left behind. We need work. Here's the thing the Democrats aren't going to want. To get it done here, you're going to have work requirements, time limits, co-pays.
Let's pick up on the rural part of this, because I want to come back to something that, Brian, you said at the very beginning of Stacey Abrams's drive to become governor. One of the things she did was she went around the state into all sorts of counties that hadn't seen a high-profile Democrat in a very long time. And Brian was saying at the time, said it on the broadcast.
I still believe it'd be true.
Said it was a bad expenditure of her political capital and of her money. She is polling right now, according to the new poll just out from the AJC and Channel 2, 2 percentage points, I mean, tenths of a percent ahead of Brian Kemp, which means dead heat. So would you think that some of what she's picked up is in those rural areas, and did that vindicate her strategy?
I just don't believe her strategy there is to close the gaping margins that Republicans get outside of Metro Atlanta. You know, in 2010, Governor Deal won Metro Atlanta by 55,000 votes. He won the rest of the state by 207,000. And then in 2014, Jason Carter won the 28-county metro area by 5,000 votes, a 50,000-vote swing toward the Democrats in Metro Atlanta, which is where all the population growth is. And Deal won the rest of the state by 206,000, very stable numbers. So that's been the Republican margin. And what Trump did was grow that margin in rural areas and turn out the people that Theron was talking about, the low-frequency white voters in those areas. And so that's why you're seeing Kemp in places that many people in Metro Atlanta have never heard of. He was in Turner County yesterday, which I don't think has made news since they had the prom desegregation 10 years ago. And so they're doing this. It's true.
Actually, I think it is.
You know, so he's out there. So she's trying to lower his margins in those. She's not trying to win Dalton. That's ridiculous. She's trying to decrease his margins. I just don't think that it's going to work.
So I respectfully disagree, because we remember back in 2002 when Democrats lost and Mayor Margaret Oliver was on the ballot, and she ran statewide in the late 90s, I think 98 or so. And so
it was 98. I covered that campaign.
Yeah. I won't tell you how old I was then, but it's okay. But here's the thing that the Abrams campaign has sort of really, and I want to applaud her for doing this, sort of bringing back sort of a hybrid version of what Democrats used to do when we would win in the 90s, 80s, 70s, and 60s and beyond, is that you would have a 159 county strategy. So as we sit here, Stacey Abrams, this phenomenal African-American lawyer, author, former minority leader, has gone to every single county and has talked to people that look like many of you in this room. As I look out in this room, I see probably about 80% white and 20% African-American and kind of a coalition of others, right? So for her to say, I'm not going to campaign to those folks because they haven't voted for a Democrat since Roy, would just be politically insanity, right? So she had to go to these counties. And so what Brian wants to really say, I think, and he won't say it because he's one of my favorite Republicans, but what some Republicans will say, not Brian, not my good friend Brian, is that these white folks in these rural areas are not going to vote for this Metro Atlanta DeKalb County black woman. And part of that is true, but there's also a different effect, and I keep going back to Trump. So if you are one of these disaffected Republicans, and I won't ask you to raise your hand because I know you're out there. I've actually talked to a couple of you today, and you feel like you now belong to Trump Party, not the Republican Party, not the Republican Party of Lincoln, not the Republican Party of Reagan. I mean, where is the compassionate conservative? I have not seen he or she in a very long time, because there's nothing compassionate about this president. So what the Abrams campaign... So what's different, Dennis, is that Abrams is the one candidate that has not raised $20 million, because let's not forget, Roy Barnes raised $20 million.
He did.
What she has done, and which is just remarkable, by the way, I think that she's the first ever African-American statewide candidate to raise this much money. So what she's done effectively, Dennis, and this is one of the reasons why our podcast does so well, is that we communicate with you all, and so this is 60%, 65% of the electorate. So if you're on radio or TV in the metro area, I mean, you're communicating to almost 6 million people, depending on how you guys get your news. So what she did was is that she spent an enormous amount of time doing that long runoff that many Republicans just boo-hooed about, and she really built up her name recognition in the metro area. I mean, she defined herself before Brian Kemp could define her. So with being so intentional about defining herself, I feel like she thinks that there's not many undecided voters in the metro area. So now she can spend these last weeks of the campaign going into some of these rural areas, as you pointed out, that have not seen a statewide Democrat in over 10 years. And Brian is right. She's not going to get every one of them, but if she can pick off 5 to 10%, or if she can do it in a way where she gives those African Americans and those white Democrats, who many of whom left our party in 2002, who voted for former Democrats as Nathan Deal was a former Democrat, and Sonny Perdue. We forget that. Sonny Perdue and Nathan Deal were former Democrats. So they were known as Democrats in these rural areas for a long time. And so at the end of the day, the one thing that Stacey Abrams does not get a lot of credit for is that she has raised the amount of resources to dominate the media market here in the metro area, and then also have the resources to put the boots in the ground in the rural areas.
We'll be back with more on the Political Breakfast Podcast. Stay with us.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
We are back with the Political Breakfast Podcast, a live audience edition at Emory Law. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson, and a great group of folks here at Emory Law. Once again, give yourselves a hand. All right, we will get to your questions very soon, so be thinking of them, and we're going to get to the other races, because as closely watched and as high profile as the governor's race has been, there are some other interesting ones. But I want to close out on the governor's race with the whole kerfuffle over the on-again, off-again Channel 2 debate. Brian, I'll start with you. The Kemp campaign was really quick, at least on social media, to try to turn it around and say, Stacey Abrams postponed this debate on us or canceled this debate on us. But
when you have gone through, and you know, you've worked in campaigns, logistics at this time of year, especially when it comes to debates and rules and times and schedules, are absolutely insane. When that is done, when that cancellation comes on short notice, doesn't that put Brian Kemp, no matter what he says, in a difficult position, even if you understand, hey, look, the president's coming to campaign for him, you'd probably want to go be with the president.
No. I don't. I mean, this is such a slam dunk decision for Brian Kemp. And here's what happened on that, as best that we can glean. And Theron and I both talked with WSB.
Well, I don't mean that when I say difficult position, I don't mean is it a difficult decision for him to make. I mean, is it a difficult position in terms of voter perception?
No, voters do not care about debates because, look, this is 2 days before. They don't. I mean, they haven't moved numbers since the Kennedy-Nixon debate in 1960. I don't think anybody thinks that Donald Trump pummeled Hillary Clinton on the merits of debate strategy during those three, and he's president of the United States. I don't think anybody thinks that George W. Bush was a master debater either. And he became president of the United States. I don't think it matters. Like, 2 days before the election, there's no undecideds. And so the entire idea of the debate is this antiquated thing from when there were a lot of undecideds. Americans weren't as partisan as they are today 50, 60 years ago. And so Nixon and Kennedy had a chance of going and persuading people. And today, all we're doing is turnout. I mean, it's just like getting your people to go vote. And so what is Brian Kemp doing on Sunday? He is having a rally with the best turnout operator for Republicans in the country. And he's doing it in rural middle Georgia and will dominate national news that day.
Then why bother to say, instead of saying, hey, look, sorry, guys, I've got a campaign with the president for all the reasons you just stated, tough luck, and instead try to blame Stacey Abrams and saying, well, she canceled the debate on us.
Because they said, we can't do that time now because the president's coming. We'll do any other time. And Stacey Abrams' people didn't want to do another time. And so that's what they were saying there. But look, I don't think either one of them are crying about the fact that this isn't going to happen. Because why? One, both of them, in the last days of a campaign, they're not scheduled by the hour. They are scheduled by the minute. They are slammed. And they're getting up at 4 in the morning and getting home at 10 or 11 o'clock at night. Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp are exhausted. And so they've got to take a day off of the campaign trail to get ready for a debate. You have to do so much preparation for it. You've got to rest so you don't have bags under your eyes and have a bad visual on television. A lot of it goes in, and so much stress is built around these dumb debates that have a viewership of 100,000 people or something. And the only thing, here's my bottom line, the only thing that can come out of a debate for either side is bad. Because if they go out there and just get their talking points, which is what they did in the GPB debate, nothing happens, right? But the only thing that would move numbers would be something extraordinarily gaffy.
So raise your hand if you watched the first debate.
This is not a good focus group. This is not a good focus group for that question.
I didn't cut you off, my good conservative friend.
That was 50% plus one.
No, that was about 70%. But by a round of applause, clap if you thought that Stacey Abrams won the first debate.
Right. Yeah.
Clap if you thought Brian Kemp won the first debate. So, okay, well,
yeah, but you've just proven that there are a lot of Democrats in the room.
My good,
congratulations.
No.
That was not obvious before.
My good friend Chuck Taylor taught me this, right? So here's the thing, a couple corrections, because for those of you who listen to me and watch me, I always try to deliver the facts. So as we sit here, Brian Kemp became the Republican nominee 100 days ago. So when you become the nominee, you get your party affiliate, your lawyer, and your campaign lawyer and designee, and you get the Democratic campaign lawyer and Democratic Party designee, and they get in a room. My sources tell me that they basically went through almost 100-plus dates, going back and forth, okay, what does this date work for you? No, Brian Kemp has got to, you know, go to the shop to pick up his pickup truck to round up illegals.
Oh, you laugh at his pickup joke. watch.
No, Stacey Abrams, you know, this doesn't work for you because, you know, you're too extreme and you want to go to a Bernie Sanders rally that day, right? The two campaigns selected two dates. They selected the first date where you guys watched, and they selected this Sunday. What Brian Kemp did is that he broke a promise to Georgians because, no, it's true. Because as Brian knows, the Republicans in Georgia, which Purdue and the Purdue's, one is actually in Washington with Donald Trump, and actually both of them are in Washington with Donald Trump, and they took credit, but basically interfering in the Republican primary to help Brian Kemp become the Republican nominee. So you mean to tell me that Brian Kemp's people could not call someone in the Trump administration to say, President Trump, I know you have this full Sunday. You know, we look at your public record, and two Sundays ago, you had 5 hours blocked out on your schedule to play golf. And if you look at Donald Trump's record last Sunday, he had a Halloween party and one other event, right? So we know you're not that busy. But could you maybe come down in the morning, Sunday morning? Or better yet, you know, we know President Barack Obama is going to be in town on that.
Republicans are in church on Sunday morning.
No, Republicans are not in church on Sunday morning. You can use that all the time.
Yeah.
When's the last time you've been to church on a Sunday morning?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let me
finish my point.
It was Sunday.
So you could easily, remember now, we got a U.S. senator who is Trump's right-hand man. You got a former governor in Purdue who is Trump's right-hand man. And you got many people that are on the Pence staff that are famous Georgians that could have said, ooh, the Kemp campaign has a very important debate with WSB-TV, which, by the way, if you go on WSB-TV, and Brian and I just did it today, you're talking to almost 70% of the market. So for those of us in politics, you want to go on that station and other stations like Fox 5 and others because you want to get your message and your face out. So this whole thing about, oh, we couldn't tell the president, who, by the way, flies everywhere else, to come down a little earlier or come down on a different day, it's just false. The Abrams campaign also told me that they were never offered alternative dates and times. But Brian is correct about one thing, is that when you're in this stage of the game, you are basically, your schedule is already planned out. And so I think the fundamental choice here is that Brian Kemp made a decision to use Donald Trump as an excuse to not debate someone who he really didn't want to have a conversation with. And to be fair, I really hope that the Abrams campaign figure out an innovative way to even get any coverage on Sunday, because this is what Brian knows, and he's a really good media specialist. When any former president or president comes to town in any city, that president dominates the network. So let's just say that...
Unless Oprah's in town.
Well, and then you made my point as we close. I think that the one thing that Democrats are winning right now is that we're the cool party. Would you guys want to go see Donald Trump or Mike Pence?
The next event.
Or Barack Obama or Oprah? And I don't care what you say. I know a lot of Republicans who love Oprah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you can't be mad at Oprah. And so one of the things that I think that was a good counterpunch to this sort of Trump distraction was to bring down, I believe, the number one person who motivates Democrats more than anyone else. That is former President Barack Obama. And then when you bring Oprah down, I mean, my fiance was almost late coming here tonight because she wanted to go see Oprah. And she waited 3 hours. And so I think that, honestly, WSB also had to make a fundamental decision, to be fair. If you were to let a Democratic candidate go on and debate Ted Metz, who, by the way, I want to get this fact in before we move on, Dennis, got more Libertarian votes in 2014 than any other Libertarian on the ballot. So as we look at this kind of runoff strategy, for some reason, people are voting for Ted Metz, and it may be around hemp and other things as well. But the one thing about this Abrams campaign, I want to commend them publicly, is that they changed the narrative, because no one else is talking about whether or not they're going to debate. They're talking about Oprah. And let me tell you something. When B.O. comes to town on Friday, you think Democrats are fired up now. Wait till he hits the stage. It's going to be a show.
I don't usually talk much at length during the podcast, but this is something I actually have some experience with. Most of the time, I'm just the inexperienced guy throwing out dumb questions. But I have been involved in debates for years. With the Atlanta Press Club, where I was on the debate committee, served one term as president of the press club, and then at WABE have produced a couple of debates, including the Karen Handel-John Ossoff debate. And after going back and forth with both of those campaigns, now you know why I retired.
It is hard.
It is. Anyway, anyone.
It's a lot. It's a lot of drama built up around it. There's so much time that goes into it, and I'm particularly sensitive to it because that was my job.
Yeah.
Every campaign that I've ever been a part of was my job to do the debate prep, and to my point about the debates not making that much of a difference, if you go and look at the primary debates in the Republican side, in full disclosure, if you listen to the spots, you know I was with Casey Cagle, and in that last WSB debate between Cagle and Kemp, Cagle was the obvious winner. I mean, he really did a much superior job. And then, 9 days later, he lost by 40 points because Donald Trump got involved. And that was the deciding factor. It wasn't any of those debate things. And look, Brian Kemp's not afraid to debate Stacey Abrams. Let me hit that head on. He's not. And even though she is so highly skilled, I mean, she is a Yale-educated lawyer. She was widely seen amongst Republicans as the smartest member of the General Assembly. No offense, Mary Margaret. I mean, you're two. You're a close two. She is to be feared. If you don't fear her going in, you're dumb. Because I have seen her eviscerate Republican committee chairmen and just de-pants them in front of an audience. Because she knows the legislation better than they do in their own committee. And you have to be very careful. But in a debate setting, it's very hard for her to get the throat shot that takes him out, right? Because of the time limits and the rebuttals. All he has to do is speak to his audience. He doesn't have to beat her on the merits. He doesn't have to prove his idea. He has to speak to his audience, and she has to speak to hers. And that's all it is.
But real quick, in 30 seconds, Dennis, I think the thing that it's so interesting, and for all of our millennials in the room and our season, people with social media, because when you have a debate, if you really watch a debate and you're following it on Twitter or you're following it on Facebook or you're following it on different social media platforms, the campaigns have an opportunity to really amplify their message. And so Stacey Abrams can talk about Medicaid expansion. She can talk about how she wants to be a public education governor. And then you have the ability to have celebrities and other surrogates tweet it out or send it out on Instagram to their followers. And so I think that that's the one thing that by having a debate, the people get the information. And the last thing I kind of want to push back on is that I do believe that there are some undecided voters out there. I mean, this last poll showed that 5% of the electorate, the people that were polled, are undecided. And I think it's a duality of people not really wanting to tell a pollster who they're going to vote for, because they may think it's somebody from Russia calling them on the phone or something. Or they truly are torn because they don't really know a lot about the candidates. And so ultimately, I think that, WSB TV, to your point, Dennis, they went through a whole lot to try to get this debate to happen. But just buckle up, because I think that you got a couple more big surprises that are going to come from the Kemp campaign and come from the Abrams campaign. I think that whatever they've been holding this long, I think the Kemp people were probably holding the flag, even though they said they didn't have anything to do with it. And I'm sure
the old tape
and everything.
Stacey Abrams burning the old Georgia state flag.
She didn't burn it. She was present.
She didn't burn it. Yeah.
She photobombed it.
She photobombed the burning. But, you know, stay tuned because, you know, we like to say in campaigns it's the October surprise, but I think there's going to be another big November surprise before Election Day.
Let me just throw out the perspective for a moment. Take privilege here for just a second. Having worked on debates for as long as I have, I don't envy the position that Channel 2 was in. They couldn't make a right decision. And I will bet you there were some internal debates about the debate there. Now, I don't know that. I haven't spoken to anyone there, and I don't presume to know. But from the experience that I've had with the press club and at Public Broadcasting Atlanta, when something happens like that, when somebody says, I can't do this, or I want to change that, after you have spent, as Theron was telling you, weeks and months going over this with the campaigns, suddenly they're in a position where they either go ahead and risk the perception that they're favoring one candidate over the other, or they risk the perception that they're being pushed around by one candidate or the other. It is a no-win situation. At the press club, our resolution of it, and I'm not speaking for the press club, I'm speaking for myself as someone who worked with them. What we did was we said, okay, here's what you agreed to. If you don't show up, we're going ahead. There's going to be an empty chair there. Now, that sounds like an easy decision to make. In the end, at least from my point of view, it was like the only one we could make because of the logistics involved. But we knew that there was a perception that, oh, you're just going to be unreasonable, Press Club or Channel 2 or whoever. You're not going to try to work with a candidate. And that's a risk they ran, too. I do not envy the position they were in.
One last thing. Stacey Abrams will be in Southeast Georgia on Sunday while Brian is
rallying Republican voters down there.
No. There's Augusta, Savannah. That whole media market's got a lot of Democrats down there.
That's true. They do.
All right, we're going to turn into the British Parliament here. It's question time now, and we're ready with a microphone, so you can step right up, tell us who you are and where you're from.
My name is Wayne Book. I'm from Atlanta, just down the street. Mr. Robinson, what has happened to Brian Kemp's shotgun?
Yeah. Interestingly, in polling, when you get to the part to the verbatims, and that is, you ask the respondent a question. That's not, there's no like A, B, or C. It's just like, why do you not want to vote for Brian Kemp? The number one response in verbatims is he put a gun on a kid. Number one response. If you want to go shake the record, Brian Robinson said on the record a lot during the summer that this is going to be a problem in a general election. it is something that has stuck with him. That's why you're seeing that ad replayed in Stacey Abrams's her ads. Like, she's rerunning his stuff. And I don't begrudge his strategy because it worked, right? I mean, he won the nomination. And when you're in that spot, you don't care about the general. You just have to win the next one. You got to live to fight another day. And Kasich Cagle had a lot more money, a lot more name ID, and he had a big lead in the primary. And then Kemp was these clustered together with Hunter Hill and Clay Tippins, and nobody was breaking out of that cluster. And he put that ad up, and he broke out of the cluster immediately, like a rocket, or maybe out of a shotgun. And that, and then the truck ad as well. It worked for him, and I think he was the one who captured the zeitgeist of the Trump Republican Party better than Casey did. And we knew we had that problem. I mean, we knew that Casey wasn't in that mold. He wasn't in that Trump mold, and he wouldn't be, you know. And what you heard on that secret tape was his frustration at being put in that box, right?
Secret tape, by the way, was made by Clay Tippins, one of the other candidates. It was kind of a surreptitious recording of a conversation he had with Casey Cagle.
Low down, dirty dealings with a really corrupt man. What you saw there was was Casey's frustration with that dynamic. But look, Trump is the what drives the message in the party today. When he tweeted on Wednesday before that Tuesday, Brian had gone a little bit ahead in the two or three weeks out, and Casey that last weekend had those NRA rallies with Colonel North and got good coverage. He won the WSB debate. Nathan Deal endorsed him. Things were like going his way. The momentum was shifting. And internal polling, we could see Casey lifting a little bit ahead of Brian. Not by much. He was going to be tight as this election is going to be on Tuesday. And then Wednesday happened, and it was over immediately. It went Casey's character rating. Like, the question is, do you think Casey Cagle has a good character? That rating dropped 30 points in 24 hours.
Because of President Trump.
Because President Trump tweeted something positive about Brian Kemp. Brian Kemp was not driving a negative message against Cagle at the time. Trump did not attack Cagle, but just that stamp of approval from Trump, you know, put a black mark on Casey Cagle. So Brian did what he had to do to break out of the pack. It worked. A lot of Republicans, you know, in our polling, we saw that 25% of Republican primary voters hated his ads, hated them. And we had to hope that those people all became fervent Casey people, but 25% wasn't enough. And I think a lot of that 25%, just like with Trump in 2016, there were a lot of Republicans who were anti-Trump during the primary. I admit I was one of them, because the tapes are pretty clear on what I said.
They certainly are.
but when push came to shove, a lot of those people became Trump voters. And a lot of those Republicans, well, really, polling shows all of those Republicans became Kemp voters. So why that ad matters, though, is that where it's hurting the most is with white, college-educated women. Like my wife, who is a, you know, straight-ticket Republican voter, was repelled by it. I mean, it really bothered. And I hear that a lot from my women peers. And then that's the battleground right now, is white college-educated women. And Stacey's only pathway to winning is to crack that egg and to get a lot more of those white college-educated women, married women, than Democrats have gotten in the past.
Next question.
Hello, my name is David Orozco. I am Latino, and you had mentioned the whole, this is not Kemp's attempt to, I'm paraphrasing here, not showing the race card. However, his original ads showed him on his truck saying, I'll go ahead and put those illegals, as he put it, which is very, very negative, in my truck and taken myself. And I'll also add that he is with Trump, and Trump's main message is, I'm going to wrangle those up, and I find that to be extremely racist.
Theory, and I apologize. I probably didn't get all the questions because
let me add on to your question if it's okay. Let me add on to your question if it's okay. Because one of the current debates centered on what you just talked about, sir, is President Trump's thought that he could end birthright citizenship with an executive order. And whatever one thinks of birthright citizenship, there's also the debate over whether he can do that at all because of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. So anyway, Brian, I'll start with you, and then Theron very quickly. On the gentleman's question, whether the president raising this now raises the specter for Republican candidates, including Brian Kemp, that they might be tying themselves to somebody who is a racist.
You know, let me say why that ad worked or why it didn't hurt him. In the Republican primary electorate, which is where that ran, those issues pull off the charts. You know, interestingly, two of the cultural issues that really popped, and one of them to the candidates' credit, they didn't use. But the two things that we saw that really popped, one was immigration. I mean, it is Trump's party, and Trump saw something that no one else saw, right? I mean, He saw the frustration with the illegal immigration, that we're not doing anything about it, and that it's continuing, and the pressures that it puts on the country. And look, does it speak to some cultural insecurity about the demographics changing too fast? Yeah, sure, probably does. But it's something that Republican voters across the country are very concerned about. It moves voters, and you've got to show them that you're with Trump on that issue, or you will lose, period. Do not run as a Republican if you're not with Trump on that, because you don't have a chance. And so what Kemp was successfully doing there was saying, hey, I'm with Trump. His worldview is my worldview. If you're trying, if you like where he's trying to take the country, you know, I'm your guy. And that worked. 90% of Georgia Republicans think Donald Trump is doing a great job. 90%. Okay? And so you've got to be with him or you're going to lose. The other one that nobody used was Theron mentioned not being able to measure intensity. Well, there is a way to measure intensity on issues. Like, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much do you care about the removal of Confederate monuments? It scored a 9 in the polling that we saw in 2017. So that was a huge, huge motivator for Republican primary voters. And nobody used it because it's, you know, the New York Times is laying in wait for those kind of stories, but that's you have to speak to your audience. And you know, here's the thing, you know, Theron was talking earlier about saying extreme or radical is racist. We're getting to the point, and this is you're seeing Republican voters respond to this with anger at this juncture. That if you have a viewpoint that's different than liberals' viewpoint, then your viewpoint is racist. And Republicans are with Trump partly because he's standing up and going, no, we're fighting back. You know, it's okay for you to think what you think. And I do think he captured something there that was out there. There's a frustration of us being told everything that we think is racist.
So I'm going to push back real quick. So I can't let him legitimize the racist behavior by this president.
I'm not. This is what Republicans are responding to right here. This is it. This is what Republicans, they're tired of it.
Calm down.
They're just tired of it.
Well, let me just quickly interject here because Brian said something and I just checked it. The AJC Channel 2 poll, of the people who responded to that poll and identified as Republicans, 9 in 10 of them support the president.
So here's the thing, and I was going to say Joe Larchet, who's a good friend of mine who's here, he taught me how to breathe and don't get angry. So and I'm just picking with you, Brian. But no. Here's the bottom line to your question, and I'm going to agree with Brian a little bit and then disagree, of course. So he's right. Look, guys. I mean, I'm a realist. There are people who are not in this room who voted for Donald Trump for a lot of reasons. I believe one of the main reasons was because they literally hated Hillary Clinton, right? And let's go a second step forward, is they saw a African-American president for 8 years, who, by the way, had a 56% approval rating in the last 3 months of his election, because that's when we truly saw the economy continuing to turn around. And Trump is taking all of the credit now for turning around the economy. But the sad thing about where we are as a country, we have now gone from a country that other countries and continents basically were trying to be like, were trying to get to this country because we were so great. But now we are sort of the laughing stock, because I travel to Europe, I go other places, and the number one thing when you guys travel, for I know this is a group that travels a lot, is they want to talk about Trump. And they want to talk about that we can't believe that you guys are a country that was founded on religious freedom and a country that is full of immigrants. We all are immigrants, right? I mean, you may be different in how you came over here or when, as my mentor and my hero say, you know, we may have come over in different ships, but we're all in the same boat now. John Lewis tells us that all the time. Brian is right. There are some people who feel left behind, who didn't like that they had a black man being president who was scandal-free. Trump's administration is the most corrupt administration ever. And fact check me on that. Like, go ahead, look it up. That's fine. You know, y'all can look me up on Twitter. Tweet me. I'll tweet you back. If you look at the amount, and I shouldn't say that, China, I know, because she don't like it when I go back and forth with people. But if you just look at the amount of corruption, the amount of secretaries and cabinet members who have been indicted, campaign officials, going to jail or in jail. But the one thing that is so disappointing for me is we do have people out there, and Brian is right, that support this president because he wants everyone to believe that every single immigrant is an illegal immigrant who wants to come over here and harm us, steal, rape women, sell drugs. And let me be very clear. I'm going to say this as a Democrat. If an immigrant comes over here illegally with the intent and with the sole purpose to murder Americans or to rape women or to try to sell drugs and have no desire at all to try to get a pathway to citizenship, then I'm against that too, and I'm a Democrat. But the problem is that we also have upwards of 15 million people who are here, who are dreamers, who were born in this country, who they should not be, disgraced and basically tarnished by this president with his rhetoric.
But this came up, and we're going to have to be real quick here because I want to get some other questions. But this came up and has come up as an issue in this campaign, where Secretary Kemp has accused Leader Abrams of wanting to give the Hope scholarships to illegals, as he put it. And what she's referring to are the Dreamers, if I understand correctly.
And I support her on that. No, Dennis, this is the thing.
But is that, does that?
It's a humanity issue. If a student is in this country and they are in high school in the state of Georgia and they meet the requirements to receive the Hope scholarship, they should be able to receive the Hope scholarship. And I've heard Stacey Abrams talk about this. What she really talks about, Dennis, is that you can't leave out the part about needs-based. There's a group of students out here, and newsflash and shocker for you guys, when we talk about needs-based, the Republicans, and this is 2018 Republicans, some of the Republicans who Brian have worked for, they want you to believe that when we talk about needs-based, it's black people. Guess what? It's white people who needs-based too as well. And they are some of these.
Hold on,
let me finish.
Let me just define the term here for folks.
They get it. This is an educated audience. They know needs based. They need to get some assistance in order to basically get the scholarship.
Scholarship. Okay.
And so, look, there are some suburban kids in some of our suburban counties that can't make it. They don't have the good grades. So they also need education. So I'm a little riled up about it because while Brian is correct, I'm not attacking him. It's just sad of where we are as a country. And I truly believe that the notion that Stacey Abrams has got to convince these college-educated white women, look, to you college-educated white women out there, don't take this the wrong way, but it shouldn't take a candidate to convince you to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you guys should really look at the issues and the character of the candidate and look at their qualifications, not the color of their skin and not the party they belong to. And so I think that she wins by also getting a lot of people of color who feel like they have been disenfranchised, feel like they have been suppressed, and I think those folks have got to turn out to vote as well.
Brian, as quickly as you can, on that point, Secretary Kemp clearly made a calculation here because polls have shown that people in general favor making it possible for dreamers to have some benefits of having been born here or being brought here because out of no choice of their own. So what was the calculation, near as you can tell, and does that translate into a winning issue in terms of driving his turnout?
I would say that when it comes to the Hope Scholarship, which is something very specific, it's not just a benefit, it's something that's near and dear to Georgians. This is something that in 2011, we had to greatly reform. I was a part of that.
So was Stacey Abrams.
And she was part of keeping it merit-based, for which she caught a lot of flack for.
Stacey Evans,
fact is, with the demand on the scholarship being growing every year, the revenues are sort of topped out. I mean, we would have to come up with a new way of bringing in new money for us to begin to restore some of the money that's been cut from the Hope. And so when you start talking about bringing in more beneficiaries in a system where there's a pot of money and it's okay, there's this much money, this many students, we divide it up by that many students. That's how it works today. And so there's more students that you have in there who may be illegal immigrants, the less money there is for people who are here legally. And so I think it's a really safe issue for Brian Kemp. I think that, you know, outside of the Clifton Road corridor, this is a fairly slam dunk issue that people don't want their benefits being taken away. And look, you can disagree with the Republicans, but the Republican Party's platform is solid on this issue. If you're not here legally, you need to go home and come back.
We got time for a couple more questions.
Hi, my name is Ryan Veek, and I am a married, college-educated white woman.
Hey, shout out to the college-educated white woman.
So, yeah. And go dogs. But
go dogs.
Go dogs. I agree with you on that.
So, not sure how to phrase this. I'm a little nervous. Okay. I guess my question is, what is it going to take for both political parties to stop ignoring and dismissing an option of a third party? Because I almost didn't have, I was undecided probably for like the first time ever, because I was pretty unimpressed, kind of depressed about the two candidates. I'm like, no, I'm going to vote because you have to vote. So my generation is eventually going to realize that voting is important and you have to vote. What is the part, what are the parties going to do to acknowledge that besides being so extreme? Like, how are you going to get to the middle?
I'll be quick. I think that most Americans, Ryan, are like you. I've seen studies, I've read articles where the majority of voters under the age of 35 identify themselves as quote-unquote independent. And so it's a problem for both parties. The Democratic Party is looking at it very closely because you're right, both parties have become very polarizing and extreme. But I think the one factor also, Dennis, 2 seconds, is that the Libertarian Party, the Green Party, all these different parties have to figure out a way to raise money in order to elect the candidates that they want to elect. And also,
ballot access is a tough one, too, and that's decided by legislatures made up of Democrats and Republicans. Isn't that the problem, Brian?
It's very difficult to get on the ballot to run as an independent and to make a splash. And I think, here's my theory on the whole thing, is the parties will continue to evolve, right? The Republican formula for winning elections is one with a time limit, right? I mean, the maximize white vote is not going to last much longer. And that's why you're seeing Stacey Abrams have a chance in this election, is because the time's about up for that formula in Georgia right now. And that's why there's so much attention on Georgia from the New York Times, Washington Post, and all these other outlets, is because we're sort of at that tipping point. Well, the nation as a whole is getting toward that tipping point as well. It's a little lagging behind us because you have a lot of states that are, homogeneously white, like along the Canadian border. But the nation as a whole and the population is changing so fast that Republicans are going to change how they win elections. And so we as Republicans, I'm saying stuff that y'all don't agree with. But what I'm saying is pretty mainstream Republican thought, right? And I know it's not popular here, but it's sort of how it is. And I have said, though, for many years on this show and many others, Republicans have got to start bringing in minority votes. They've got to have a message that appeals to them. And some of my black friends tell me, Theron doesn't say this to me, but others say, Republicans are going to be shocked when they find out how conservative black people are. And, if they just would, have a message and try with them. And that's something Republicans have to do. And so the evolution, I think, is going to revolve around that. The parties will change. Look, Trump changed the party in one cycle. And the Democrats have changed dramatically in reaction to him. And so both have gone towards the sides. There's going to be something that happens cyclically. It will self-correct, particularly if we have a big wave election. The party that loses will make changes. And so, for whatever reason, third parties don't work in America. I wish they did. I wish there was a party for pragmatic centrist. I wish there was. That's what I am.
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Sarah Manning. I'm actually a transplant. I'm from New York City, and that's kind of where my question comes from. You know, I was a part of the more Bernie movement, but I did vote for Hillary, and I know a lot of people that were like me didn't, but I also know that a lot of them like me happened to move to a lot of the southern states, including Atlanta. Are you not taking into account, one, the fact that a lot of the millennials are fed up with a lot of the situation going on are more willing to vote for the party that holds more of their beliefs, which is the Democrats? And two, do you think that you're not putting into account the fact that there's a lot of transplants for within the last 2 years due to the tech boom, movie boom here, et cetera, that do come from the North, that do vote Democrat most likely?
Yeah, on that point, real quickly, Vice President Pence said, you know, in talking about Oprah's appearance for Stacey Abrams, he said, this isn't Hollywood, y'all, this is Georgia.
He said, this ain't Hollywood.
Ain't Hollywood, sorry.
Yeah.
This ain't Hollywood.
Yeah.
This in a state that's trying to attract the movie industry.
Right, yeah. Well, he's
and
from Indiana.
And what's so crazy about that statement is that he actually serves as the number two to the biggest Hollywood reality TV show guy ever.
But anyway, to your point, sir, real quickly, Theron, we'll start with you.
Yeah, I'll go quick. Look, man, you are the voter that the Democrats have got to not only have a message to appeal to you, we've got to consistently stay in contact with you in the off-election years. When you look at things like eliminating the cash bail bond, that's an issue that I think that most millennials probably agree with. When you look at legalizing marijuana, that's also an issue that I think some of you guys deal with. But more importantly, you guys want more transit options, right? So we're not even talking about transit. The Republicans just spent all this time passing one of the biggest transit bills in the state legislature, and we're talking about it 0% in the gubernatorial race. And so I think that Stacey Abrams reminds us that in 2025, that Georgia is on track to be a majority-minority state. And the largest minority of that majority will be African Americans. And so look it up. The Browning of America is something that Republicans are very, very afraid of. But one of the things that Brian has heard me talk about for 3 years is this demographic shift. And the truth of the matter is, if you look at the early vote numbers in Gwinnett and Cobb, and you look at Congressional District 6, where a lot of these college-educated men and women live, and people like you who come to school here or probably come here for whatever reason and stay here, you guys are going to elect the next, you know, governor and presidents from this state, because it's just, we can't keep up with the pace of the quote-unquote transplants moving into this metro area. So whichever party can appeal to you will win elections in this state for a very long time.
You know, I saw polling in September that showed that amongst women of all races in Georgia between the ages of 18 and 32, Stacey Abrams was beating Brian Kemp 73-16. Damn. Oh, now you clap for me. Yeah, thanks. You guys are great. And it goes to the point that I was making to Ryan. Look, you know, the Republican strategy for victory involves a lot of older white people. You know, if you look at the turnout models, and it's a lot of people over 50, that's a really good sign for Brian Kemp. If you see a lot of rural vote, that's a really good sign for Brian Kemp. If you see a lot of men, that's a really good sign for Brian Kemp. The gender gap is tremendous in this election. It's not as stark, of course, as the racial gap. You know, almost 90% of African Americans will vote for Abrams, if not more. I have trouble believing it will be less than, you know, than 90%. And, you know, Brian Kemp's got to get about 70-75% of the white vote. You know, Nathan Deal got around 78% in his reelect. And so it's really hard to keep that monolithic vote going forward, because the Democrats do it with, you know, with various constituencies. But Republicans are going to have to modernize. I mean, for example, 15 years ago, you were seeing these anti-gay marriage constitutional amendments on the ballot all over the country, and they were passing overwhelmingly in all of those states. Today, with the, you know, Trump's people did do this transgender stuff recently, but you don't see Republicans talking about gay marriage today. And that is something that, and you're seeing more and more Republicans saying, hey, lay off of my state's marijuana laws, just leave us alone. So you are seeing some evolution there, but those strategies won't change dramatically until we have wholesale generational change. You know, that the older white people who are keeping Republicans in majority, when they die off, essentially. And it is. Y'all are evil.
Ooh.
That is evil.
Tough route.
Yeah, this is.
It's true, but you know, before the marriage ruling, I always said every day an anti-gay marriage voter dies, and a pro-gay marriage voter signs up. Right. So you're not. You won't see. So the debates and how we center around them will change. What we talk about will change because some of these things that have been so divisive, eventually is going to be an overwhelming majority in agreement on a lot of these things. So we'll disagree about something else. Just like so many Democrats agreeing with President Trump begrudgingly on trade because a lot of them are labor guys, anti free trade movement. A lot of Democrats actually like what he's doing on that. That's one of those things where we can have some shift in the issues we talk about.
We are, yes, sir. Last one. Okay. Hi.
Hello, my name is Grant Polk. I go to Chamblee Middle School. Do you think that the exact match system and other methods of voter checking registration are voter suppression? And if so, how would you fix those issues?
That for me?
What's your name again?
Grant, I think.
Grant, that's right. Grant, thank you
for
your question.
Was that right, Grant? Yeah, okay.
And what Grant just did is just showed us the future. Like, he read the question from his phone. So the exact match legislation that, by the way, for those of us who do not know, it came up in 2014, I believe. It's the first time that the state started talking about this exact match. And Mayor Margaret Oliver, tell me if I'm wrong, it was voted on in the legislature in 2017. And so what happened is that the Democrats in the state legislature voted against it, and they said, hey, this is bad, because now you want every single person to make sure that they don't forget to put a comma, put a hyphen. If they go by Thomas and they use Tom, or they go by Richard and they use Rick, I mean, any little thing. And then more importantly, Democrats raised the issue that you would have to make sure that your DMV driver's license and your Social Security information match what you put on your new voter registration form.
Real quickly, do any of you know? I mean, I know that mine doesn't. Does anybody else have the same? Know that?
So yeah. I guarantee you, for the sake of time, if we were to actually, everyone in this room, And everyone in this room, you guys are taking out the time tonight to come to hear us speak. I would bet that over 40, maybe 30, 40% of you, your driver's license don't match your actual voter registration card, and it probably doesn't also match what you have in the Social Security database. So, and I think I see a lot of head shaking, right? And so, but if you have been going to the same polling place for many years, and you've never had to experience that, even if you've moved, or even if you have you've renewed your driver's license, right? You probably haven't experienced that. And the one thing about the exact match is that it also affected white people as well. But what really made it all racial is that 70% of the people who were affected by the exact match at a time where we're in a state where 30% of the people are African American, 70% of the people that were on the exact match list were African Americans. So it gave the allure and it inferred that there may have been some type of targeting to try to keep newly registered or re-registered African-American voters from voting. So what Brian Kemp could have done proactively is said, hey, Dennis or Brian or Theron, even if you guys forget to do this on your form, even if you forget to change your driver's license or your Social Security card when you re-register, don't worry, you still can show up and vote provisional, so you are not being restricted. But unfortunately, a lot of voters were not educated on this exact match law, which is, by the way, in a lot of other states. And so I think that what can be done about it is that hopefully John Barrow, and I know we didn't talk about any other people running for office, but hopefully John Barrow And what's the guy's name? Raffensperger, the conservative?
Brad Raffensperger.
Yeah, the conservative, Raffensperger. You know, that's going to be a big issue for them. So I encourage anyone who is on the exact match list to make sure you go and vote. And I was talking to Chuck earlier, who he said he's had someone who actually has experienced this and was kind of told that they couldn't early vote. And so I just encourage you, no matter what, just show up to the polls and do not get out of line. Make sure that they let you vote provisional. And if they refuse to let you vote, pull out your cell phone, record the entire conversation, put it on TMZ, you know, tweet it out, Facebook Live it, and just make sure that it gets out there.
I'm sure the New York Times will live stream it for you, yeah. The fact is, we registered 900,000 new voters in 4 years. We have registered more under Brian Kemp's tenure than any Secretary of State. African-American voters in Georgia vote at the same percentage, if not more than, white Georgians do, and which is a great credit to our state that the African-American population here is so politically engaged. Our state legislature, the African-American percentage, it reflects the African-American percentage in the state. Our congressional delegation, the African-American percentage, reflects the African-American percentage in the state. So what more do you want us to do?
I mean, don't gerrymander us.
Oh, my God. Y'all have got to be kidding me. Y'all have some really short memories.
Thank you.
You have some really short memories. You look at our maps and you compare them to the last Democrat map in 2001 and then clap for that because that was garbage with multi-member districts.
I will tell you a story about that just really quickly because it kind of illustrates what both of them are saying. There's a former Democratic state representative that Representative Oliver will remember, Doug Teeper, who I interviewed after a Democratic gerrymandering session. And he said, party in power just does what it wants to do. And there was a former Republican state senator who I met in the hallways of the Capitol after he had been written out of his district by fellow Republicans. And he said, when it comes to gerrymandering and or redistricting, and Ms. Oliver, you can vouch for this, you have no friends, even your own party. So, yeah, I mean, it's a power move, and that raises the whole question of, well, should we, you know, let, say, the Vinson Institute at the University of Georgia take over that job? You know, but, yeah, I mean, I've been around long enough to have watched both parties do it, and they do it very well.
Both parties do it, and it's just a matter of, you know, Maryland's districts are very gerrymandered for Democrats. New York's gerrymandered for Democrats. It's just how it is. I personally think that system is broken. I think it needs to change. Georgia cannot unilaterally do it because it's not fair to Republicans if Democrat states aren't doing it, but I think we are moving more toward the nonpartisan redistricting, which I do hope will change some of the polemic nature of our conversations. Mm-hmm. It's happening in different states. Iowa's going to it. California's going to it. No, you're...
Oh, yeah. Just so folks listening, because you wouldn't hear the audience, the gentleman in the audience says, is there a conversation in the legislature about that? Representative Oliver, sitting not too far from us, said, yes, there is.
Here's the point, Representative Oliver, is that it doesn't get any traction because we have 2/3 majority of the Republicans in the Senate, and we have almost a 2/3 majorities in the House. And so while it's come up for 10 years, Republicans refuse to actually have a robust, pragmatic conversation about it.
Do you think that if the shoe were on the other foot, if there were overwhelming Democratic majorities in the House and Senate, the idea would get any more.
I'm
going to be very honest with you. I think here's the difference. It's very hard for a Democratic controlled legislature to basically not get a lot of pushback from its constituents when they try to discriminate on any race or gender or demographic or geographic. The problem is that Republicans can do it because the Republicans' constituency won't criticize them for doing it. So the difference is Democrats can't do it because African-Americans, Hispanics, Asians, Indians, everybody, they won't let them disenfranchise any community. But the problem is Republicans get away with it because Brian just illustrated for us that the party here is made up of majority old white men. who don't get involved in legislative issues like that.
We are out of time. I want to thank Theron Johnson, Brian Robinson, and everyone here. And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Our special thanks to the members of our live audience and to Emory Law School for hosting us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist and former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. By the way, Theron and Brian will join us the morning after the election, Wednesday, November 7th at 9:30 on 90.1 WABE for a special broadcast to analyze the results and look ahead. Hope you'll join us then. And if you like this show, subscribe. And you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. It's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.